Good evening. Welcome to the first session of Positive Psychology. Thanks for all of you for being on the call. Positive psychology is the study of what makes life worth living. Dr. Martin Seligman, in some experiments, was watching some dogs, and they were not performing according to what the other experimenters were wanting, and he saw that they were experiencing something that he called learned helplessness. Well, he took that idea and he tried to think of, could he turn that into learned optimism with dogs? And then ultimately he turned those experiments with people, and he found that optimism was something very important, and moreover that optimism can be learned. However, before we go further into learned optimism, we're going to review the document entitled The Psychological Foundation, Mental Models, because mental models or how we think really underlie the understanding of all of this stuff. So let's dive into the material with the question, what is reality? Well, it turns out that we all have our own realities, because we all have our own mental models. Based on our experiences and how we see the world, we've all developed attitudes, beliefs, truths, and experiences which act like a filter or like a window that we look through to see the world, and we see it from our perspective, which is unique and different from everybody else's. So is there any real reality? No, actually, there are very multiple realities, because we all see things differently. There's basically no such thing as the truth, because we each have our own truths. So what do mental models have to do with happiness and optimism and resiliency? Well, our mind works really at least a couple of levels, both our conscious thought, of which we are aware of, and those things that are going on in our head subconsciously that we are not even aware of. And so what's really happening is when we see something, we are actually oftentimes responding to our subconscious thoughts, reacting based on those, rather than our conscious mechanisms. To the extent those subconscious thoughts or beliefs are negative, then that would tend to put us toward a pessimistic point of view. To the extent that those subconscious beliefs are positive, that would put us into more optimism mode and are likely to be more resilient. Now, many of you may have seen the movie or read the book The Secret, and so question is, can you relate any of this material to the content of The Secret? What The Secret basically says is that the power of our subconscious is extremely powerful, and that our thoughts really resonate with the rest of the universe, and those things that we think about tend to be brought into reality. Thus, what The Secret teaches us is that we should visualize in great, great detail what exactly we want to accomplish and how we want to be, and just continue to think about that, and then the universe will just open doors to us in our lives so that we can accomplish that which we have visualized. Some theorists believe that those things that we visualize are no different to our subconscious than things that have actually happened, that our subconscious cannot differentiate between imagined and real events. An example of this with sports is using the concept of psycho-cybernetics, in which basketball players would visualize making free throws over and over and over again, perfect form, swish, and then they would actually go out and shoot and be considerably better than they started. Now, we may differ in whether we believe The Secret works by the law of attraction exactly the way it says, that it always happens and such, but one would tend to believe that there is at least that tendency to believe, and to the extent that we believe something is going to happen, it's much more likely to happen than if we don't believe it's going to happen. That we can all probably agree on. Our mind works in mysterious ways in which we all have blind spots, or what some people have called scotomas. In the materials is a statement that reads as follows: finished files are the result of years of scientific study combined with experience of many years. Now, the exercise asks you to count the number of F's in the statement, and what happens is people most often do not count the F's in the of's because they're pronounced as V's rather than F's, and we skip right over them even though we're looking right at them in that bold printed statement. There are so many things going on in our environment that we cannot really absorb all the detail. So we have what's called a reticular activating system, which is a part of our brain, and which keeps an eye out for the things that are important to us. Now we filter some things out, and we selectively see, hear, and feel other things. Now we couldn't possibly absorb all the stimuli that are coming from our environment, so this is a more or less a protective device, and through evolution apparently was helpful in selecting out those bits of pieces of data and information which was personally important, those things which create opportunities or those things which create threats. Obviously threats are the ones that we needed to react to immediately back in the cave days, so that we could very quickly react and protect ourselves. Examples of this selective filtering device is if you're walking through an airport and the public address system says so-and-so is to report to baggage claim G. Normally that just goes right through and you don't even hear it. But if someone was to say on the public address system that Rick Olson, please pick up a courtesy phone, my ears would pick right up, and you'd hear that because it's personally important to you. We just pick those up. A similar thing is noises in the night that you would otherwise just disregard while in bed. A mother could hear the baby's cries or something, just boom, just like that, and respond to the baby's needs. Now again, this may relate to what the secret was talking about, but to the extent that we are very aware of what our goals are, what we are trying to accomplish, we then open up our filtering system to be more receptive to those things that would be important to achieving those goals or objectives. Well, in addition to blind spots or scotomas, and the filtering device we've just talked about, we also have a mechanism in which we set limits. For example, the 4-minute mile was a psychological barrier that existed for many years, and once it was broken, many people broke the 4-minute mile in the following year. It was as much psychological as anything else. Now, in the materials on page 12 and 13 are pictures of some ladies, which many people are very familiar with. These were in Stephen Covey's book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And basically, the point of this exercise is our past experience colors what we see in the future. And if you see a picture of a young woman and then see the composite sketch, you are likely to only see the young woman. On the other hand, if you had only seen the picture of the old woman first and then you see the composite sketch, you would likely see the young woman or the old woman. And in fact, when this is done in exercises of groups divided in half, sometimes they get into quite different serious arguments about what's in that picture until they're shown each other are shown what the other had seen first. So take home message there is that past experiences very much color what we see today. Also on page 13 is an exercise with some black blocks of irregular shape, and people are asked to see what is it, what does that say. And seeing as we are used to seeing print in black against white background, many people have a difficult time seeing the word fly in there, which the words are, or the letters are actually in white, surrounded by these black irregular blobs. Many people have a great deal of difficulty seeing that until they're explicitly told where to look. So again, our brain works funny. Seeing as we're used to seeing things in certain ways, that's the way we want to experience the world now, rather than perhaps the way it is in some very different way. A very important concept in improving communications between people is the concepts of leaps of abstraction up the ladder of inference. I got this from Peter Senge's work, in that basically what we often do is observe data and an experience, and from that data we select something, and then we add meanings, either cultural or personal, and we make assumptions based on our experiences. From that we draw conclusions, then we adopt beliefs about the world, and then we take actions. We can go from a very specific observable fact and go to a generalization very quick. We make these leaps of abstraction and up this ladder of inference. Excuse me. An example of a leap of abstraction up the ladder of inference would be Jane hearing her boss tell her, "Your performance is not up to standards." Jane observes the boss is chewing her out. She thinks her boss thinks her work is unacceptable, and further that he picks on her because she is a woman. She concludes that this boss should not supervise women. Another example is a boss observing John entering the meeting at 9:20, despite the meeting starting at 9 o'clock. The boss thinks that John knew exactly when the meeting was to start and that he deliberately came in late. He next thinks, "John's always comes in late," and he concludes, "We can't count on John. He's unreliable." Note the huge jump from an observable fact of a man coming in late to the generalization that he's unreliable. So we have to really be careful about this, and I encourage you to think in your background of things that may have happened where something got taken totally out of context, an innocent action got generalized to something that was way out beyond what was actually happening at the time. Now, one of the ways that we can spot leaps of abstraction is to first ask ourselves what we believe about the way the world works, and then ask ourselves, what is the data on which this generalization is based? Or you see an action and you come to a leap of abstraction and you make having a very great emotional response to that. You might ask yourself, what is the evidence that my generalization upon which is it's based? We may have, once we slow down our thinking and go through this process, we may say, maybe I better ask a question. Maybe I make sure that my data is correct. The next topic is differences between people and the value of diversity. I once experienced a diversity training program in which the result was an effort to make the white males feel bad because of previous prejudice and discrimination that white males have imposed upon females and or people of color. One of the great opportunities lost in that exercise is to really see the value of diversity. As we've talked about, every one of us has different mental models. We all see the world differently. And because of this, when we work as a group, we have a number of people coming from multiple directions and see, quote, reality as different realities. If the group can utilize the expertise and experiences of the diversity in the group, there is the opportunity to come up with more potential options, more perceptions of the way things are, maybe more perceptions of maybe the causes of a problem, and generally come up with better decisions. This process obviously requires the ability to tap each people's perceptions and uses the techniques of inquiry and advocacy, as we talk about in how to do dialogue. But this can be very, very powerful within an organization where diversity is valued, not just because of diversity, but because of what diverse people bring to the process. The point of all this is not that mental models are either right or wrong, because, by definition, all models are simplifications. The danger of our mental models is that their accuracy is rarely questioned, that we are usually even unaware that we have them. We simply assume that the way we see things is the way they really are, or the way they should be. Because we remain unaware of our mental models, our models remain unexamined, and because they are unexamined, the models remain unchanged. As the world changes, the gap between our mental models and reality widens, leading to increasingly counterproductive actions. Therefore, the question is not whether the mental models are right or wrong. The question is whether they, and the actions they generate, are effective in getting the results we want. An action or behavior pattern may work in one circumstance, but not necessarily work in another. We repeat behavioral patterns, even in inappropriate circumstances, because they worked at some time in the past, either for us or for someone we love or respect and wish to emulate. The behavior pattern is based on our mental model for achieving the result that was achieved in the past, which we wish to replicate. When an attitude or behavior seemed to work for us once, or seemed to work for someone we admired, we cling to it. We keep using it, even when it seems not to work anymore. Unfortunately, the situation is never exactly the same as it was in the past, and the action may not be effective in achieving the results we want now. Mental models can therefore not be judged effective or ineffective until we not only know what the current situation is, but also know what we want to accomplish, what result we want to achieve. The goal is to become more aware of the extent to which we are influenced by our experience so that we can take responsibility for those mental models. I challenge you to begin the lifelong process of identifying your mental models, begin to examine them, test them against reality, listen to others, and be open to their perceptions, and therefore get a larger picture and a far more objective view. The discipline of managing mental models, surfacing, testing, and improving our internal pictures of how the world works promises to be a major breakthrough for personal growth and building learning organizations. We need to learn how to change or to let go of ineffective attitudes, behaviors, or emotions that are inconsistent with your overall purpose or definition of success, so that significantly more of the results you want naturally occur, without going through a life-threatening crisis which causes you to suddenly see your priorities in a different light. Results are the only indicator of your intention. Results are 90% intention, 10% mechanism. A conscious intention may be overridden by unconscious intentions we are not even aware of. Therefore, if our results are not consistent with our conscious intention, we must examine our mental models to discover what is really governing our actions. There may be a difference between what we say and what we do. If we want to change situations or results, we first need to change ourselves, and that to change ourselves effectively, we first have to change our perceptions. To try to change outward attitudes and behaviors does very little good in the long run if we fail to examine our basic mental models from which those attitudes and behaviors flow. So in summary, in this module, we've learned that our beliefs, attitudes, and opinions affect our actions and results, that we act and perform not in accordance with the truth, but only the truth as we see it, and our past experiences through our three thought processes, the conscious, subconscious, and the creative subconscious, form our attitudes as well as our self-image. Our subconscious records all of our past experiences and can greatly influence our perceptions, judgments, and decisions. Our creative subconscious causes us to act in a way that is consistent with our beliefs. And mental models are attitudes, beliefs, opinions, truths, theories, either simple generalizations such as people are trustworthy or very complex theories, also perceptions, assumptions, understandings, ways of interpreting data, mental maps of the way things are, mental maps of the way things should be, that is values, points of view or frames of reference. Also, we see the world not as it is, but as we are, or as we are conditioned to see it. We all have learning disabilities or challenges, such as leaps of faith, filtering devices, rationalization, lock-on, lock-out, cultural trances, and self-imposed limits. Blind spots keep us from seeing the truths and the optional truths around us. We make leaps of abstraction, jumping from direct observation of concrete data to generalizations without testing the accuracy of the generalizations. Beneficial blind spots lock out unneeded and necessary information. We have a natural filtering device in our brain that allows only the profitable information and threats to get through. We sometimes rationalize to gain psychological comfort in the face of conflicting beliefs. We lock onto things we are familiar and comfortable with, and lock out other ideas or approaches. A cultural trance exists when a whole group of people believes something, such as the world is flat, or no one can run a 4-minute mile. We build barriers and restrict ourselves by beliefs we hold regarding what we and others are able to do. People are different because of the differences and experiences we have had. The differences are valuable in collectively seeing a larger picture. To develop and achieve excellence, we must think differently, see options, be open to new ideas, and recognize our untapped potential. Now, you were asked to take the Authentic Happiness Inventory questionnaire available online at the Authentic Happiness site. Now, the Authentic Happiness Survey was simply used in many experiments to test the happiness level of participants at one time and then later after some treatment. So don't read much more into it. I just wanted you to become familiar with that assessment to just get a sense of where you are on the happiness level. Obviously, we all like to be happy, and that might be a useful thing. But I just, like I say, wanted you to be familiar with that, because in future sessions when we do various exercises, you may want to go back and take that assessment again. Now, your assignment for next week is to do the gratitude visit. So the instructions that I'll send you will give you instructions on how to write a letter about someone who you wish to express some gratitude to, and then, if possible, to go visit that person and read that letter to them. If it turns out that someone's far away and you can't actually go read the letter to them in person, perhaps you could do that over the phone and then send them the letter. But it's more effective the more personal you make it. So I would encourage you to do that exercise, enjoy it, and get the results. This is one of the experiments done by Dr. Seligman online with multiple participants with controls and so forth, and this exercise has been scientifically proven to boost your happiness level. So I hope you take it and you get the similar results to the other participants. That's it for tonight. Thank you for joining me, and we'll see you next week.